And a lot of that, you need a lot of people for that. And so I'm probably not going to actually give these people enough credit in the talk, but basically a lot of this stuff is John Dudley has been running Cosmo MC nonstop for about 2 years now. And Alex Van Engelen has been busy rederiving everything about how to do gravitational lensing in the CMB. And they're both grad students. They're graduating soon. Okay, so I'll just give you what we're going to do. So I'll start with some background, just so we're all on the same page. Get lunch, you know, through us so we can then really start getting ready to go. And then I'm going to talk about the sort of stuff we've been doing with the South Pole Telescope. And in particular, I'm going to pick out two things which I figured would probably be interesting to people here. So one is we have a huge catalog of massive clusters of galaxies, and this goes out past redshift 1. And these are some shockingly large objects. Like, these things are 10 to the 15 solar masses at redshift 1, which I think everyone that ever looked at them went, my God, how could these things possibly be there? And then you actually go and do the calculation, and it turns out they should be there. So it's a little bit disappointing. We haven't discovered non-Gaussian initial conditions in the dark matter, but yeah, that's okay. They're still pretty interesting. And I'm going to talk about gravitational lensing in the CMB. And so what we're doing there is we're actually making maps of the total integrated matter between redshift 0 and 1100. And they're honest to God maps, you know, sort of constellation size maps, and I'll show you one of those. Okay. So we all know about the CMB. Here's a map made by the South Pole Telescope. So this is something like, you know, maybe 15 degrees across and 10 degrees this way. And there's some chunk of sky like this, and that's the cosmic microwave background. And you can see it's just splotchy. It's a Gaussian random field. There's nothing interesting going on in this thing. So that's the CMB. So what else do you see in these maps? So there are all these dots, and these are galaxies. Who cares about galaxies? And these black dots right here, and there's another one somewhere else. But this black dot right here turns out to be a 10 to the 15 solar mass cluster, redshift about a half. And so those are the things we're finding. We basically just go sifting through these maps. We do all sorts of stuff with the microwave background. Some people do some stuff with the white spots. And these dots are these huge collections of hot gas into anywhere between redshift 0 and 1 point something.
So how come we decided to go with black and white and color? Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to actually get a good color stretch to work, because the problem is that these sources are way brighter than these fluctuations. And so these things are really, if any color stretch you use, these things are going to be some weird color. These things will be some other weird color, and the rest of the background just kind of looks like puke. So it doesn't really work.
Why is it like that black?
It's a hole in the microwave background. And
it's not bright.
It's hot gas, and so I'll get to it in a second, but it's Compton scattering, and you're observing below the peak of the black body. You're in the Rayleigh genes, and so if you have a bunch of gas and you're observing below the Rayleigh genes and you have it interact with something hot, then the first thing it does is it starts to warm up, but you conserve photon number because it's Compton scattering. So on average, every photon gains a bit of energy. But it gains it in the wrong way, so that it drops below the blackbody curve. And you end up at low frequencies, you get a hole in the background. Okay, so here's the plot that we're all used to seeing. This is the standard plot that everyone shows in the cosmology talk these days. And so it's the WMAP evolution of the universe. And here's the surface of last scattering, is what people call it. And you say you're down here, and you observe the surface of last scattering, and then you have some other telescopes you look at all these things with. But there's more to the story than that. So what actually happens is here's the surface of last scattering, and as a photon comes across the universe, it's going to get deflected, and that's just gravitational. So there's some lump of mass right here. It's going to move it out a little bit. It's going to bend it in, and then so as it propagates through the universe, this photon walks around. And it's just gravitational deflection, right? It's walking around as it goes through the universe. Some other photon from the surface of last scattering comes along, and if there's a big hot cloud of electrons or any electrons anywhere along this line of sight, every once in a while, it's going to ping off an electron. It's just Compton scattering. And it turns out 10% of CMB photons actually get deflected on their way to getting to us. So 10%. So that surface of last scattering is only true for 90% of the photons. What was that? Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. The 10% of them have been deflected out of the beam. So 10% of the things coming this way get deflected out by hitting electrons, and similarly, 10% of the photons we see were coming from some other direction, hit some electron, and then came to us. So what this means is that if you actually look in fine detail at the CMB, not only are you learning about the surface of last scattering, you're also learning about all of the stuff that's in the universe. So you can learn about exactly what's doing this gravitational deflection. You can learn about what's doing the scattering.
Where's this 10% number come from?
That's just if you integrate the number of electrons between us and here, it turns out to be you get a Thomson scattering optical depth of 10%. So it's just the Thomson cross section times the length.
Can you quantify how often, how length it is? You're in line with bending a lot. Is it kind of lensing, on average two or three times, or is it if you kind of ask?
So the
average bending or something.
The average amount of bending is about 3 arc minutes. Two or three arc minutes.
How many galaxies do that?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you could just have some Gaussian field, right? And you could just, and it, so it's not necessarily, it's just sort of, it's deflection by large scale structure.
But it's many, many small.
It's many, many small deflections that are building up. For the most part, yeah. And so what you find is that in general, this whole CMB is getting moved around by something like 3 arc minutes. And the coherent scale of that 3 arc minute shift can be degrees. So you have degree scale shifts of about 3 arc minutes. So it's basically you have some big patch. Imagine looking at that window and having that whole window shift back by a few percent. And so, but 3 arc minutes is actually a lot. If you think about 3 arc minutes, those old Hubble Space Telescope images, probably the original Hubble Deep Field was probably about that big on the side. Actually, Mike, how big is the Hubble Deep Field? Yeah. So that's that, that's that whole field is actually came from some spot that was a few arc minutes over, and it just got gravitationally deflected on mass over. Okay, and so what we're trying to do is actually measure these photons and try to.
May I ask just 5 minutes?
Yeah, it's good.
I mean, they're supposed to be thinking that the universe is mostly empty.
Yes.
And so these photons are supposed to
have
a very hard time to find an energy to scatter from.
10%.
But 10%, that's why, it sounds huge.
Yeah.
So
most of that 10% is here. So what happened is the universe right at redshift 1100 went neutral. And at that point, the electron fraction went effectively to zero. Not actually zero. And so there's a huge path length along here when the scattering optical depth is tiny, as you would expect, like 10 to the minus 4. And then once the first stars formed, whenever that was, so if the first stars form and you ionize the universe, and suddenly instead of it being mainly neutral, it becomes mainly ionized. That happens somewhere between redshift, who knows, more than 6, less than 30. And those electrons, so from redshift 0 to 30, that integrated column is about 10%. And, these are, that's not zero. As you say, these are observable effects. As you saw that black dot is a scattering effect. That stuff getting scattered out of that beam. But there's also diffuse scattering just by the general intergalactic medium. And that's going on too. Well, because it's very uniform. That for the most part, so the fluctuations, so on degree scales, the fluctuations are still, percent level, even today, right? So on very large scales, so on scales like, on these scales, the universe is still extremely smooth. And so to zeroth order, all that's happening is most of these photons come in and they get scattered, and then other photons come in and they get scattered into your beams. So there's no big difference in the total flux received. And the main effect is that the fluctuations get damped by some amount. That the primary effect is that 10% of these initial fluctuations get effectively washed out because the photon that's coming from some dark spot gets kicked out and it gets filled in by some integral over all the other photons that are scattering up that same electron. So for the most part, it's just smoothing out the structure in the CMB. There's a residual effect in that because it's Thomson scattering, it can lead to polarization. So any large-scale anisotropy in the incoming field will generate polarization. This is how we observe this number 10%, from the polarization. But there is going to be structure all the way down to these, the scales of the smallest clouds. You will see structure in the CMB from this effect, but it's small because the universe is smooth. All right. So so that spot that I showed you, that black spot, that was this is the thermal Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect. And the cartoon model is you just have a bunch of cold photons impinging on hot electrons, and they start to thermalize. And how do they start to thermalize? Well, you start with some black body that looks like this, and every photon in this black body, on average, gains a small amount of energy, which means it goes from here to here. And that's below the curve. So it does the walk so that it sort of shifts this way. So down here, you see a net decrement in the CMB compared to the background. And at high frequencies, you actually see more energy. And so this is a weird spectral signature. So as I showed you, you know, you saw that map. There are all sorts of bright spots in the map. But it's very rare when you actually see a hole in the CMB. And so this is sort of a distinctive signature that makes them easy to find. So just to orient things, so if you have a very massive cluster, an optical depth is about 1%. That's the so just going through a single cluster of galaxies, 1% of the photons get scattered out. So that's one megaparsec cube where you happen to have a huge collection of electrons. 1% of the photons going through there collide with an electron. They typically gain about 1% of their rest mass. You multiply these numbers and you get a typical cluster signal is hundreds of micro-K. So the peak of the CMB, when you look at the CMB power spectrum, those fluctuations are of order 100 micro-K. So it's the same level of fluctuation as the CMB, it's just that it's very localized. That what you saw in that map was it was a little tiny dot, and that tiny dot had about the same peak-to-peak amplitude fluctuation as the large-scale splotchiness. So that's one thing we're looking for. And the other thing we're looking for is this gravitational deflection. So what might we want to do with this? Well, things we could do with this. We can do things like try to study how many clusters there are at different redshifts and use this to try to look at what's going on in the cosmic density field. We could try to weigh neutrinos with this. We could try to figure out something about dark energy by looking at how many clusters there are as a function of redshift. Now, these things are hard, but you know, we can try it. And by testing this large-scale deflection over cosmological scales, we're going out to redshift 3, right, or redshift 1100. We're getting all the matter between us and redshift 1100. We know a lot about the local universe. We do lots of local measurements. We map out the local density field very well. STSS goes out to redshift of a half. We know a lot about redshift 1100 because that's where the CMB comes from. We don't know much about in between. So if you really want to be sort of testing whether we really understand what's going on in the universe, what you want to do is you want to be able to map out the structure at all redshifts, right? So this is one way to do it. Okay, so just as a review, so what do we mean by non-Gaussianity? So the level of non-Gaussianity that we can be sensitive to is large. That in order to detect non-Gaussianity in things like how many clusters you can look at, this number has to be large. So here's a simulation. So this was 2008 by Dalal et al. And what you see is you see, so if you have a purely Gaussian field, you see this cosmic density field, you see hotspots, and you see voids, you see filaments. And as you dial the amount of non-Gaussianity in your field, you can see that you can wipe out all the bright spots, or you can super enhance the bright spots. But in order to do this, you have to have this number be on the order of hundreds to thousands. And you know, it used to be that people said this number would generically be of order one or smaller. And so now people say generically it can be whatever they want it to be. But you know, so but however. So from CMB observations, so we can put constraints on this non-Gaussianity on large scales that would clearly rule out numbers like, you know, sort of 500, you know, those are big. However, we don't know much about small scales. We could have weird things going on smaller scales in the universe. So we certainly should be looking. So we can try to measure dark energy.
What are the bounds on FNL, like, empirically?
So from the CMB, what is it? It's less than about 40 or something? Someone know the actual number? 80? Something like that. From this, so that's on the scales of WMAP. It's, you know, it's some number of tens.
So then people can't say that 500 or 5,000 is allowed. It's ruled out.
Well, it's different scales. You can have scale-dependent non-Gaussianity.
How much is that ruled out? So in other words, it's not.
Yeah, you know, it's only ruled out by plausibility.
Okay.
You know, you can say.
So scale dependent non Gaussianity with FNL in the order of 5,000 is still good.
On very small scale, on megaparsec scales, things could be that non Gaussian. Now, coming up with some way to generate a non-Gaussian density field on megaparsec scales that's not really non-Gaussian on scales of 100 megaparsecs is actually a little tricky. It's certainly worth a look.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't know if you don't look.
Okay. Is the pump similar to the other side of that? Zero?
Well, it's actually the bound is, it's slightly non-zero if you only look at it's some people's one sigma range. It's a little high. It's more negative. Negative is more ruled out than positive. I think the number is, it's some number of tens plus or minus about that number. So the one sigma just about touches zero, and then it depends on whose data analysis you're looking at, whether that thing goes up or down.
So wasn't 80 plus and minus 30 like Ben Mandel's result?
It was something like that.
Yeah.
But
so you think 2.5 sigma, or eventually sigma detection, like at that kind of way.
Yeah, and then they go away, they come back.
Has it come back yet?
I'm sure it will come back, right? It'll probably come back as 40 plus or minus 20.
One question I can't remember. If you have positive FNL, does that mean the voids are also deeper, or as well as
no.
The higher?
No,
or
it's
shallower.
It's one way that you either enhance the it's more like a skewness than a kurtosis.
Okay.
So you're enhancing the either the bright spots or the voids, depending on which way you go.
So the top panel, then the voids are deeper.
Yeah. In fact, if you actually look at the at a proper version of this, you can still see the grid lines in this one, in the voids, because the voids have barely evolved. So this is the kind of thing you could look for. So if we're trying to find massive clusters of galaxies, you can say, okay, well, if we see a bunch of things that look like this, because this is a very high density peak. So if you're looking for very high density peaks, these are density maps, that's where a cluster of galaxies is. So if we see one of these, then maybe we live in a highly non-Gaussian universe. And if we don't see enough of those, then maybe we live in a highly negatively non-Gaussian universe. Who knows? So this is the kind of thing we can look for. The other thing you want to do is you want to be able to do things like study the amplitude of density fluctuations as a function of redshift. So if you can go from redshift 0 to 3 and map out the amplitude of density fluctuations, that's sensitive to things like dark energy and neutrino masses and presumably some modified gravity theories are going to lead to different evolution of the amplitude of density fluctuation. So if you can track this amplitude of density fluctuations as a function of redshift, that's something that we want to understand. If we want to really say that we understand cosmology, well, certainly we need to know the time evolution of density. We know pretty well what it is today. We look around, you look at the local universe, we know roughly what the amplitude is. We know roughly what it is at CMB times. So we have the two endpoints, and the question is, do we actually have a model that splines those two points together? I don't know. So massive neutrinos, so this would be great to measure it someday. So neutrinos are very interesting in cosmology. Empirically interesting, so sure it's nice to measure the masses, but they also do something very interesting. So if you look at the power spectrum, and I've actually not plotted this log, so that's why it looks weird, versus K, so this is the density power spectrum as a function of K, and I've normalized these things so that they have the same amplitude on the very largest scale. So I've scaled out the linear growth, and now what you're seeing is the scale-dependent suppression due to neutrinos. So it's time-dependent scale dependence in the density. So what you see is that at redshift 3, the neutrinos suppress power by, what is that, maybe 10% or something like that, whereas at redshift 0, that's grown. So as you go to smaller scales, if you could actually trace the details of the matter-power spectrum, you can actually see how many neutrinos there are and what they weigh. So it's actually it's an interesting cosmological measurement, but it's extremely difficult.
So what's the black? What's Z for the black?
So this is with no neutrinos at all.
Oh, no neutrinos.
So this is, or redshift 1100, you could call it something like that. It's, you know, high enough redshift that no suppression has happened. So basically what's happening is that there's some scale by on small scales, the neutrinos look basically relativistic, that a 0.2 eV still has eV neutrino to a very small scale thing at such a high velocity that it just streams out of whatever potential it's in. So whereas on large scales, it looks like matter. So
what kind of neutrinos?
Any kind
like
of neutrinos. Yeah, any kind. Doesn't matter. So for the all we care about is the gravity.
Well, neutrinos could be considerably heavy. That might affect this.
So
we only know their mass differences are small. We don't know much about the mass.
There's an upper limit on the total mass. Yes.
There's an upper limit on the total mass. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
They could still be.
Well, it's already close to that level.
Yeah.
It's already close to that level.
We're actually close to the level where. You know, it's all converging in there. So 0.2 eV.
That's total mass.
That's total mass.
It looks like 3.2s, right? So that would be 0.6 in total.
Yeah.
On the particle physics viewpoint, if you don't look at that, then that's okay.
If there are only three neutrinos in the oscillator, then there's also an upper limit, which is, how does it compare to that? Can you see the...
So what, you mean like the 0.05?
Yeah, supposing the worst case scenario, one of them's mass.
Yeah, the two hierarchies?
Yeah.
So there is a signature of whether it's an inverted hierarchy or not, and you can see it, but that's really hard. In principle, you can see it, but it's tough. And the reason you can see it is because of this. It has some mass, which means to on very small scales, it's going to look relativistic. On large scales, it's going to look like matter. And where that transition happens depends on its mass. And so there's some spatial scale. Where it starts looking more like matter, and below which it looks kind of like radiation. And if you could measure that spatial scale, that tells you the neutrino mass. And so, you know, it's somewhere in here, because out here you see they all look like matter. Down here they all look like radiation, and in between there's some transition. So you could do it, but it's hard.
Do it down to like 0.1-ish.
I think people have talked about it is in principle possible to get all the way down. That if you look at what the masses have to be, that in principle the data could be taken that would let you disentangle the whole hierarchy purely from cosmological observations. That if you take the mass splittings that you need for the oscillations, that it is in principle possible to have the whole thing open up.
Is it before I retire or after?
Well, 21 centimeter would definitely do it, right? 21 centimeter does everything, right? It'll cook your dinner.
That's after I retire.
but I think people have said that even using sort of Planck plus sort of the next generation of these super BAO experiments, that just from galaxy clustering, you will be able to do this. So in principle, it could be done before you retire. I'm pretty sure it'll be done before I retire, but you know, we'll see how it goes. Okay, so these are all the things we'd like to do. Now, obviously, I'm not going to tell you what the mass of the neutrino is today because, I don't know. So here's what we're using to try to measure it. So what we're using is the South Pole Telescope, and what it is it's a 10-meter telescope. Measuring the CMB at the South Pole. And you might say, why would you go to the South Pole? Well, as everyone who cooks their dinner knows, the enemy of millimeter waves is water. And it's extremely dry. That it's high, it's high enough up that it's above a lot of water vapor just on its own. On top of that, it's always cold, so most of the water vapor is actually frozen out anyway. It's very stable, so as I like to say, everything I'm going to show you today is based on something like 3 nights of data. It's just each one of those nights was 6 months long. And it also has good support. They have a whole little club down there, right? They play bingo on every Tuesday or something. You know, they have a lot of fun down there. So it's a big collaboration. So here's a photo by Keith Vanderlyn. He's a postdoc at McGill right now, and he was a winter over 1 year. So he was down there just taking lots of pictures. And this is an honest-to-God picture. This is the telescope with the galaxy in behind and an aurora going on. That's
so how long was the exposure?
No idea. I'll have to ask Keith. Sure, you know, it looks nice. Why would
but the star's moving, man.
Yeah. And so here is another winter rover. So that's actually the moon and behind the telescope. So anyway, it's down there. It's running right now. We're taking data. It's a big team. So this is most of the team. This is more than certainly probably three quarters of the people that are currently involved. But just to give you a sense of what we're doing. So here is a map of the sky where, of course, the South Pole is on top. And here's the footprint. So this is whole thing, so everything blue right here, this is 2,500 square degrees. So the whole sky is 40,000 square degrees, so we're talking about 5% of the sky. We have 1,400 that are already in the can at our survey depth. Our survey depth is 18 micro K in an arc minute pixel at 150 gigahertz, and this is about a clean factor of 2 more sensitive than Planck. So Planck, in an arc minute pixel, if they could measure in an arc minute pixel, would have about 40 microkelvin of noise. So it has higher resolution by about a factor of maybe 6 or 7 compared to Planck, and we're 2 times deeper. However, we only have 5% of the sky. And if you actually look at what cosmologists need most, it's actually area. Area turns out to make up for a lot of problems in resolution and sensitivity. So it's 18 micro K at 150 gigahertz. It's three frequencies. We're at 90, 150, and 220, so 3 millimeter frequencies. This is our deepest channel, and it's matched so that a dusty galaxy looks the same at 150 gigahertz and 220, so that way we can ID dusty galaxies at higher channels. And an SZ decrement is the same at 90 gigahertz as it is at 150. So they're all sort of comparable, but for CMB work, this is far and away our best channel.
The null is
at 217, depending, and then there's relativistic corrections, and you know. But for all intents and purposes, at 220 gigahertz, we're dominated by dusty galaxies in the atmosphere. So we actually can't do much Sinyaev-Zeldovich work at 220 gigahertz. So right now in 2011, and we're sort of filling in all the gaps, and at the end of the year, they're going to stick a polarimeter on the telescope, and then we're going to go after measuring the CMB and polarization.
So the yellow is 4,000 square degrees, if I can read that?
Yes, right? The yellow is 4,000. That's what we're going to do when we try to stick the polarimeter on there this year, if the whole thing falls apart. We're going to go put the old camera back on and just spend next year surveying again.
You're going to see if you can get up to, it says 2,500, so you're going to be at 4,000.
Well, we're going to be at 2,500 by the fall. And the plan is to upgrade the telescope. But we're upgrading the telescope with a whole new device that's never been built before. And if for some reason there's some slip in the schedule or something weird, because the thing about being at the South Pole is you have to go down there and you have to be out before the sun goes down. And so if you don't think you can get that thing installed before the sun goes down, then you better not start. So if for whatever reason, if some miracle happens and we don't put the polarimeter on, then we'll just spend next year going to a lower declination or higher declination, depending on how you measure it. So this line right here is minus 30 in deck. And the problem with being at the South Pole is actually that a lot of the telescopes of the world are in the Northern Hemisphere. So if we've had a real tough time actually getting observations to match our data against, because most of the really big surveys of large amounts of sky are all down here. So in any case, it's a big footprint, right? You know, this is a big chunk of the sky. You might say, when I say 5% of the sky, you say, oh, well, 5% isn't very much. But when you think about a sphere, it's actually a reasonably big chunk of a sphere, right? But it's just that you look at the the geometry of that thing, and you always forget about the backside, and you forget about that bit on the bottom that you can't really see. But when you see it this way, you know, it's actually a sizable chunk. All right, so here's the data again, and so there's that dot. So that dot right here is, you zoom in on it, and there's the dot. It's still a dot. It's partially resolved. This is, our beam is about 1 arc minute, so we actually can tell that it's extended. So we look at this with a telescope, with an optical telescope with Magellan. And here are the contours of negativity that go along with this. And right smack dab in the middle of it is a big old cluster of galaxies. And it's something like 10 to the 15 solar masses, and this one's at redshift 0.4. But no one knew about this thing before. It was just sitting there, and no one had looked at this patch of sky. Why would you look at this patch of sky unless someone told you there was something interesting there? And sure enough, there is a big dot right there. So we have a bunch of these. So we managed to rediscover the famous bullet cluster. It turns out that's the brightest object in the sky. It's the biggest hole in the sky is the bullet cluster. Or maybe the second biggest, but it's a whopping SD source. It's huge.
So you mean it has an integrated box? Or?
In terms of everything. It has a very deep decrement, and it has a lot of it. It's actually an extremely massive cluster. If you actually look at the bullet cluster, it's surprisingly massive. So let's see. So the optical image didn't turn out very well. There is a cluster there in the optical. As you go to higher redshift, actually, we start seeing these things in the IR. So this red stuff means they're basically, it's a lot of Spitzer imaging. So this is actually infrared images of our clusters. And even a non-trained optical astronomer can say that there are way more red things in here than there are out here. So this is a very rich cluster of galaxies at redshift. And this one's at 0.78. This one's at 1.1, 0.62. And as you look at these things, these decrements actually are not all that different. So what you see is that these are more compact, and the reason they're more compact is because they're further away, so they're actually smaller. So we have a bunch of these. And what do we do with them?
How do they compare to, clusters that I've heard
of? Oh, so this one you have heard of. This is the bullet cluster.
Yeah.
Oh, so Virgo is actually is small. Virgo is much smaller than these. These are more like coma. They're actually not that far off coma. These are all of these are contenders for the most interesting object in the universe, as I'll show you in a second. It sounds like a burette. That's right. So what are these things? Okay, well, so here's a comparison plot. So you can put these things in context.
Well, that's the previous. Why did you skip that?
Oh, because no one cares. So what this is what we've tried to do is figure out how much these things weigh. So we don't always see is a dot, right? And you say, okay, what are you going to do with a dot? So we have a pretty big campaign, theoretically, to try to calibrate these things, figure out what these things weigh. And so the result of all our calibrations is that we think we know how much these things weigh just by looking at that dot, and that's this axis, is how much we think they weigh based on that, on their negativity. And this axis here is the estimated mass from X-ray observations with Chandran XMM. And so what this says is that, so this line right here is, I think, what you'd expect. And what it says is that actually we have a reasonably good handle on how much these things weigh. You know, so you can say, oh, well, wait a second, why isn't this line the same as this line? But the scale on this is we're talking about 10, 20%. So within 10 or 20%, we know how much these things weigh. At the level of factors, these are not factor of two errors. And it's basically just a sanity check to say, how well do we understand what we're seeing? So you take these things and you plot the masses of these things versus redshift. So all of these green dots are things discovered with an X-ray 20 years ago, are these things. So Planck just released their early sample of clusters by looking for dots in their maps. And those are these red ones. And these blue ones are what we're finding. And what you see is that, so something that you've heard of, so I think this one right here is the bullet cluster right here. And this is what I mean by this is one of the most massive objects in the universe, is the bullet cluster right there. And so there's one down here that's even more massive. I don't know which one that one is. That's probably one of those ones with Hubble images with all those arcs. I don't know if you've ever seen. There's a couple Hubble clusters that just have a ridiculous number of arcs all over the place. And that's, I bet that's that one. I don't know that for sure. And so there's a few, you know, more massive ones. But we're getting all these ones out here that actually are not that far off in mass. So we're getting stuff at redshift of 0.85 that are, you know, less than a factor of 2 away in mass from the most massive objects we know about in the whole universe. And that's when the universe is supposed to be younger, and who knows what's supposed to be going on. And so you look at this, and like most people, I think the first thing you're going to do is you're going to look at this and go, that's interesting. What's this object? That's a little funny. What's going on up here? And say, are there too many things out there? So, you know, there's lots of things you could do. We'll get to that in a second.
Before you go to the next slide, so 80% of these are newly discovered, is that what you're...
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. So these are mostly new clusters.
Yeah, so the problem is that stuff out here, you know, we've surveyed 2,500 square degrees. So these blue spots are actually from a full 2,500 square degrees because we've done 1,400 to survey depth. And then we did the other 2,500 just like quick one-offs, like just to see if there are any clusters there, any really big ones. So these are only the really big ones out of 2,500 square degrees. And to confirm these things, to get those optical images, we can do sort of, you know, maybe 6 or 7 a night or something to get these ones way out here. And that's looking at, if someone says there's a cluster right there, then it takes that long just to really get something that you can believe. But if you just point at a random chunk of sky, there's no way you're going to find these. So there's really no mechanism for finding objects out here up until now. There's just been no way to find them because they're so sparse on the sky that you would never think to integrate on that spot long enough to see it. And they're rare enough that your odds of just hitting that spot are basically zero. So it's sort of, it's a new regime out here. And so that's why most of them are newly discovered. Whereas down here, a lot of the stuff down here was already known from X-rays. So there already was an all-sky X-ray survey. So ROSAT did an all-sky, so this is from a 400 degree sample, but there's also a ROSAT all-sky survey that found a bunch of clusters down here already. So again, we're in the situation where we know a lot about what's going on down here, and only now we're starting to open up this frontier out here and say, and really check this and say, do we really understand what's going on? And so far, we do understand what's going on. So if you just take a WMAP-7 allowed range and parameters, and you plot the expected number of clusters per square degree, this is the range that cosmology says you're allowed to have. So something like anywhere between 1 per 100 square degrees to 1 per square degree. All of those are actually consistent with WMAP-7 just on its own. If you look at all the points in a WMAP-7 dark energy CDM cosmology. And then you say, where are our points? Well, our points are in the middle of the distribution. So what this says is our points are not crazy. We're seeing roughly what we're supposed to be seeing. On the other hand, the size of these error bars is smaller than the spread, which tells you that we actually have some constraining power as well.
You repeated it with WMAP-7 and BAOs and blah, 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 all the other things.
Yeah, that'll go through about. The spread will go down to about the size, roughly the size of our error bars.
So sort of annoyingly. So the error bar on the CX is just the binning, right? So you could bin smaller and get more.
So this is just saying how big our bin is.
But
so
you have a lot of clusters coming
up. Yeah, so this was only done with the first 21. So this was only the first night of data, 2008. So this is all the first night of data. So we now have way more. So this is based on about 200 square degrees, so we now have 10 times more data. So we could definitely do a lot more than we've done so far. So you look at this distribution, though, and you know, a certain person is going to look at this and go, well, that's a funny object. What the heck is going on there? Have we really broken lambda CDM? And so the answer is no. So what you can do is you can take mass versus redshift, and this is just culling out the top 20-something objects from that 2,500 square degrees. And you can say, how likely is it that I'll find an object of this mass or higher? So how likely is it that I find an object of, say, at redshift 1 of 2 10 to the 15 solar masses? How likely is that? And then you can say, I'm going to put a threshold in, where if I find a single object above that some probability, I'm going to declare that to have broken lambda CDM somehow. And so this line right here is 2,500 square degrees. If you find any object in 2,500 square degrees, you've ruled out lambda CDM at 2 sigma. If you find any object above this line, that is a very rare object. This is a formalism developed by Mortensen, Hu, and Huderer just last year. And that's just saying, so if we'd found anything up here, that would be a little bit awkward. People would say, that's funny. You really shouldn't have anything out there. And if you take all of our objects, perhaps not surprisingly, they all skirt the lower edge. You know, the most massive ones skirt the bottom boundary of that line, which is to say, if you look at objects by eye and go, huh, that's a little funny, I wonder how funny it is, you're almost always going to end up banging it. You know, it's going to be sort of a 1.5 sigma outlier high, and that's what this is. So these objects that looked a little funny in that distribution turn out to not be that funny. And so this is just based on a single object. Or do any one of these objects rule out lambda CDM? Well, the answer is no. There's nothing up here. You could go further, and you could actually do a full fit.
Should we have been expecting like 1 of 20 of those things to be up against the red line?
This takes that into account. So what this is saying is that in any given universe, should you see one object above there? So So there's really only supposed to be one point on this plot. You're supposed to take the most, you're supposed to say, does this object break it? And so if we did 20 surveys, then we would have 20 points on here. But you know, what we've done is we've just gone down the list and say, are any of these weird? Because you get your list and you say, we can't tell what the rarest object is on our list. Until you put it on a plot like this. Because you have this redshift dependence of the characteristic mass, and it's hard to really know what you're doing until you fold it all through. So we just threw them all down there just to see if any of them looked like they were trouble. You know, you could imagine taking a list of your favorite nearby galaxies and putting them on this plot, right? You could put a million galaxies down here, and that doesn't make any of them more likely to ever fall up there, right? So... So you can go another way with that. You can actually take the full distribution of what we see and do a likelihood fit to cosmological parameters, and you can include non-Gaussianity as a parameter. And when you do that, what you find is that the FNL parameter that we find is 0, basically, plus or minus 450. So that's where we are. We're at plus or minus 500. So we've ruled out absurdly large non-Gaussianity, which, so that's a big error bar. Now, there actually are claims in the literature of people saying that these same galaxy clusters require this non-Gaussianity to be at least bigger than 1,000. So they are obviously doing something different than what we are. So we're doing a full fit to all the data, so we're using all the information that we have. When you use all the information that you have, you find that there's no evidence for anything funny going on. So this
are you still using a mass function that's truncated at the third moment?
At the third moment. So we've started expanding to include more interesting mass functions.
I guess I was asking, yeah, when you say that's about FNL, what was your
theoretical? So you mean what other parameters did we have?
Well, did you get that from the mass function?
Yeah.
In which point?
So we got this from Neil Dalal's prescription for as a function of FNL varying cosmological parameters.
Which is calibrated with simulation.
Which is calibrated with sims. So there are more recent versions that have a little bit more flexibility, and those are running right now. So I don't know what the answer is. However, well, actually, I do know what the answer is, right? There's the answer, right? The answer is it's not... The answer is that there's nothing here that looks in any way funny.
No, yeah, but it's better if it's Neil's perspective. It's just some of those previous papers were doing something that I didn't think was legitimate.
Right. But Neil's is good?
Yeah.
I asked Neil and he said it was fine.
Yeah.
You had to flush it out first.
Okay, so everything's working, but you know, we haven't unleashed the full survey on any of this yet. So this is using only the most massive objects from that top 2,500 square degrees. So when we do everything else, this is going to shrink in a little bit, but we're not ever going to get this error bar down to 5. You know, this error bar will go down to maybe 100 or something. All right, so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about lensing of the CMB. That's the other thing we're working on at McGill. So the cosmological parameter analysis is one of the big pushes we're doing at McGill. The other big thing we're doing is gravitational lensing of the CMB.
So can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So you need the main problem here is, or the main challenge is to relate SD observable to the mass, right?
You know, at this level, it really isn't, right? So,
okay.
You know, we're talking about most, you know, shifting things up at the 10-20% level actually is not a problem when you're looking for sort of factor of two differences. I mean, that's what you would need in order to actually start having to worry about things. So,
and that you say it's only 10-20% by comparing to the X-ray.
So comparing to X-rays and comparing to simulations, matching it together with what we see as the integrated power in the sky. So you know, we have different lines of evidence that seem to say that it's at the 10-20% level, and that's where we are. But certainly, you know, we're getting weak lensing data to try to calibrate this stuff better, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, so gravitational lensing in the CMB, well, how does that work? Well, so here's a simulation of it. So this is done by Alex. So if you start with this lensing potential, and you start with this unlensed CMB, and then you're going to lens it, and you're going to see that. It's a little disappointing, isn't it? You're expecting something super cool, but instead, it's this very slight flex. And what does that mean? Well, if someone told you what the unlensed CMB was, that would be great. You would just measure it and difference that from the measurement, and you would have this beautiful lensing map. You would know exactly how every photon's been moved. Unfortunately, you actually don't know what the unlensed distribution is. All you know about it is that it should look like the CMB, which is to say, it should be a Gaussian random field. So what's nice about this is you start with something that's an extremely Gaussian random field, and you're shuffling things around in some ordered way. And if you take something that's Gaussian and something that's random, and you shuffle things around in some ordered way, you're going to end up with something that's not random. So imagine generating a string of 100 random numbers and adding a half to some stretch in the middle. You're going to be able to tell that you've added a half to those ones in the middle, even though you don't know individually what any of those things are. If you start doing structured things to intrinsically random things, they become less random. So what that means is that there are correlations induced in the CMB by the lensing that you can use to reconstruct what's been done to it.
How well do we know the lensing potential?
We don't. That's what we want to measure. Yeah. Well, that's one thing you want to measure. So what's the easiest thing to imagine? Okay, so here's what does lensing do? Well, lensing stretches stuff. It stretches it, it squishes it, it shears it. So you start with something that could be round, something happens to it, and it gets squished, right? So in this case, this is what people do when they try to measure weak lensing with galaxies, right? This is what Mike does all day, right? Or at least he did do. I don't know if he still does that all day. Yeah. Okay, but now imagine that I take some gradient. So I have some plane wave. And I do the same thing. I'm just going to stretch it. In this case, I'm going to take this plane wave and compress it. So, well, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that this characteristic gradient in angular scales on the sky has changed. I did have some characteristic gradient, which was that I was changing by whatever this amplitude is every this many arc minutes. And now I'm changing by that same amplitude by this number of arc minutes, which means I've increased the gradient. So wherever I take that map and I compress it, the gradient is actually much stronger. So a simple way to go find gravitational lensing is to just take the gradient of the CMB and look for spots where it's higher than you think it's supposed to be.
Your slide says smaller.
Where gravity compresses, gradients are smaller. That's interesting. Yeah, that's not
gravity stretches gradients. You might
yeah.
want to fix that.
Yeah, I should fix those. These are at odds, right? So the gradients are over smaller scales. Sorry.
Okay.
But it, you know, the main point is that where there is some distortion of the map going on, your gradient gets screwed up. And so this is just if you're doing some compression or compaction. If you do some shearing, then it means your gradients are no longer isotropic. And it's supposed to be an isotropic Gaussian random field. So if you just look at the distribution of gradients, you can actually see where there's shear going on and where there's actually compression and expansion of your map. And so effectively what this means is that the way to look for gravitational lensing is you take the, something like a gradient of your map and you square it. You just look for extra variance in your gradient map. And so you can go further than that. You can actually tune it. You can do some matched filter that instead of using a pure gradient, you can use something with some shape to it. And instead of doing a gradient times a gradient, you can do something like this gradient times something like this gradient. And there's a whole literature that's built around figuring out exactly which filters to use. But they're all some flavor of taking the gradient of your map and looking for fluctuation spots that are extra noisy and extra quiet. And so by doing that, this is the sort of thing you can expect to do. So this is an input potential, and here's what you can recover if you had an experiment that was a little bit better than SPT. So this is what we were using at the time. This is an old slide. And what you see is that you don't get everything, but you actually get a lot of this structure back. You really can make a map of the large-scale structure. And this is over 17 square degrees. Right? So we're talking about something almost the size of the Big Dipper. This is a huge chunk of sky.
So this is the quadratic estimator?
This is the quadratic estimator, yeah. So so here's what comes out of it. So here's a lens simulation. Here's a different unlens simulation, where I just just to get a sense of what we can trust in the map and what we can't, and here's one of our maps. So this thing here is 20 degrees by 10 degrees. So I've smoothed the crap out of this to get rid of all the noise. But what you can see is that there are actually honest-to-God blobs. And these are real matter fluctuations between us and redshift 1100. And someday, so we need a galaxy survey to correlate against. But if someone can get us a galaxy survey that has a lot of stuff at redshift 2 or 3, what you should find is that when you stack those galaxies on top of each other, so this is actually a void, what you should find is that there should be holes in the distribution at those spots. So the color scale is a little wonky here because clearly zero is not right where it's supposed to be because there's not enough pluses. But in any case, you know, this is real. These are honest to God mapping the dark matter. That if you look at this patch of sky, I'm not going to tell you where it is, but if you look at this patch of sky, we have made a map of the total matter, dark matter plus visible matter, everything. And so this is going to be a legacy data set for people to cross correlate with for a long time. So if you do this with Planck, because their sensitivity isn't as high as ours, that factor of 2 turns out to really kill them. That factor of 2 means that their maps will never have structures that by eye you can believe. That if you could imagine adding sort of something like 4 times the noise to this map, imagine if this was 4 times noisier, you're not going to be able to trust any features in your map. So it'll still be good for cross correlations, but you won't be able to just look by eye and go, aha, there should be something right there.
What is the signal to noise at that
map? So these blobs are probably like 3 sigma, something like that. So a couple of these blobs are almost certainly not real, and some of them are. That's where we are. So we have some patches that are much deeper. And when we do it in polarization, these maps will get a lot better. So this is one of our fields. But we're actually, these are the first steps towards actually making large-scale maps over hundreds of square degrees of the total matter distribution.
So it really looks like the lens and unlens simulation interpolate between the red devil. Because you have these hot spots.
Yeah, but you know, there's how many hot spots you're going to have. So maybe there's a hot spot, maybe there's not. So you can actually do this more quantitatively, which is to say we can take a power spectrum. And so here's the power spectrum of that map. And what you see is that we actually have a very high fidelity detection. This black line is the WMAP7 expectation, which is to say That's not a fit to the data, as you can see, because it actually misses. There's, you know, something a little squirrely here. That's why this is coming soon and it's not published. We're not quite sure why this is low.
Negative.
Yeah, well, it's because we have to subtract off our noise. And so we should be able to calculate our noise in principle perfectly. And yet, when we calculate our noise, it's for some reason a little squirrely down there. We're not quite sure what's going on. But, you know, there's no signal out there anyway. So we shouldn't be worried about these data points, except that once you've looked at them, you kind of have to worry about them. But what you see is that actually we are detecting exactly as much power as you should see. And what this is saying is that the amount of lensing that's going on, mainly between redshift 2 and 4, is surprisingly close to what you would expect. And so this is a recent result from the ACT collaboration, where they did a similar thing with bigger error bars. And what you see is that, again, it looks as if lensing is going on as expected. So that's kind of where we are. So our red points right here, this is based on about a fifth of the SPT area and only one of our frequencies. So we should be getting something like an improvement of a factor of 5 or so over the next year and a half.
It's really too bad you're in the set, because in
CFHDLS
we have all these
square Z's
over 200 square degrees, and you can see if there was something there in galaxies, right?
So do you get to redshift 2? Okay, yeah, that'd be great. Oh, well. But there are people that are going to be doing, you know, so DES is doing a survey that is exactly over that whole 4,000 square degrees. So in the next coming few years, we will have data sets to work against, and we actually have a Herschel observation over 100 square degrees. It's coming this year. And Herschel galaxies are actually perfectly matched because most of them should be at redshift 2 to 3. So we are going to have stuff to cross-correlate with soon. But right now, there isn't very much. Okay, so I'll just close with this. So I hope I've convinced you that there's a lot of structure formation information in the CMB. That it, you know, people often think about structure formation as being galaxy surveys, but it's not just galaxy surveys. We can do this with CMB experiments as well. So with SPT, we have a big cluster catalog, and we can do all sorts of interesting things with it. And so we haven't found any evidence that the usual lambda CDM model is broken. Everything seems to work surprisingly well. And we have detected gravitational lensing through non-Gaussianity of the CMB. So remember, this actually is a detection of non-Gaussianity of the CMB in some way. That's how we found this mode coupling. So it's just not the non-Gaussianity that everyone is looking for. And so with this, we actually have these maps over, you know, constellation scale maps of the total matter in the universe. I'll leave it there.
So if you think constellation, and which constellation is it?
Depends on the map. So we have some maps that are the size that are 200 square degrees, and some of them that are 80 square degrees. But I don't know. I just find that amazing. You know, because you think about the sky, and a constellation is big, right? I mean, that's a big object, but it's actually a tiny fraction of the sky. There's a huge number of constellations in the sky, right? So imagine looking up at the Big Dipper and then having a map that's that big of the total matter. I mean, that's it's a big chunk.
SPT constellation somewhere?
No, the sky seems to be covered, right? They don't seem to be giving out new constellations.
There's a telescopium.
And it's in the south somewhere. It might be in our field. I was actually trying to embed these things in Google Sky the other day just to see where we were, but the maps don't look very good in Google Sky.
So, can you make a, presumably you can adjust your weights and your channels to make a map of the scattered photons, right? Of the, in effect, of the SC signal across the whole sky.
The SZ map, yes. So,
not the
large scale diffuse stuff. We could do that with different frequency weightings. We could do. So the problem is that, and even though we are at the South Pole, which is extremely dry and extremely stable, it is. I think most people would agree that for millimeter wave maps, it is the best, most atmosphere-free place on the planet. That even there at 220 gigahertz, we see a lot of atmosphere in our maps. And so what that means is that so what you would like to do is have a map that has the CMB in it and say the SZ, and you would like to be able to subtract out the CMB. But in order to subtract out the CMB, you first have to measure the CMB to the same accuracy as the RMS you want in the map that you're left with. And in order to do that, it just turns out we would have to spend so long integrating down at 220 gigahertz to get the atmosphere down that it's not worth it. Because at 220 gigahertz, you're starting to hit the dusty galaxies because you're in the Rayleigh gene side in dusty galaxies. So you just spend a lot of time imaging the submillimeter background, basically. If we were to, in order to get the atmosphere low enough to be able to remove the large scales, we would be imaging the submillimeter background to very high precision, which some people want to do, but not us. Yep.
So on that topic, can you measure kinetic semi-annisole dimension effect for
these? Yes, in principle, we can. So the only thing that we're worried about is doing it with our own clusters. There's this problem in that if you put some cut in your distribution at, say, 5 sigma, and say we're only going to see things at 5 sigma, that means that whenever you're sitting on top of a negative noise fluctuation, it's more likely to get into your sample. And if it's just noise, it's not a big deal, because you might say, oh, it's on 150 gigahertz, maybe the other channels, it doesn't matter. But there's a signal on the sky which is real noise, which are dusty galaxies. And dusty galaxies are at high redshift, they're redshift 2 to 3, which means they get lensed by the stuff in the middle. And what that means is that you can start with some population of dusty galaxies that are, say, you know, some galaxies that are like this, and then you take some region and you're going to lens it. You're going to zoom in on some region and look at it, and sometimes this beam is going to fall on one of these objects, and it's going to take this thing and stretch it out so that this thing here is then going to get really big, and you now have this blazingly bright submillimeter galaxy in your map. And we actually have a couple times where we see a big bright submillimeter galaxy right on top of one of our clusters, and it was just fortunate that it didn't get lensed by enough to totally fill in our cluster. That happens about 1 in 20 times. But all these other times, your beam lands on a hole in the submillimeter background. And if it lands on a hole in the submillimeter background, that means you're actually getting real signal in the sky that's negative from gravitational lensing. And if you are more likely by your selection to be getting the ones that have holes, then that means that you actually are going to have this preference for detecting things that appear to be moving toward, you'll think that they're moving, I guess, away from you, even though they really aren't. And so it turns out that this differential lensing effect is annoyingly close to the signal that you would want to be measuring to do kinetics in Yazdel-Dovich.
That'll be true for Planck as well.
So. Yeah, and it's not.
But if you have multiple frequencies, you can separate this.
And if you look at clusters that you didn't select as being necessarily bright in SZ, it's not a problem, right? So it's for stuff that's nowhere near your threshold, it's not really a problem. But it's enough of a problem that every time someone has started to do this, they've run it. Anytime someone is in the collaboration has started trying to find kinetics in Yazdel-Dovich, they run into this and go, oh. And there's so many other things to look at that, you know, in the limit of infinite grad students, this would be done.
So, is anybody doing any kinetic
SD
with anything?
I'm sure Planck is. I'm sure. Yeah. They are in the limit of infinite something, right?
Not necessarily true.
They're in the limit of infinite number of people saying they're doing things, at least. Now, I think Planck will be able to do this with nearby clusters. So if you just compile a list of Abel clusters, you don't have to worry about the selection effect because you're not selecting things that are more likely to have landed on holes. So if they just take nearby clusters and do this, it should work fine. It's just it's hard for us to do it with our sample because our sample has been selected in such a way that we're more likely to get things that have this little negative glitch.
More questions? But if not, then let's thank Gil again.